Mark Edelson joins me from Iron Hills Brewery to discuss brewing commercially. This is Beersmith Podcast number 251.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 251, and it's early February 2022. Mark Edelson joins me to discuss how a craft brewery decides what to brew. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also the new Brew Commander, the brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. To order yours today, visit BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I'm happy to say the web-based version of Beersmith is available now at BeersmithRecipes.com. Beersmith for the Web lets you edit and brew recipes from any browser, including your desktop, tablet, or mobile device. The new web version gives you access to tens of thousands of recipes, online recipe editing, advanced water tools, and much more. You can try Beersmith Web for 30 days by setting up an account at BeersmithRecipes.com. If you purchase a Gold, Platinum, or Pro license, you get both Beersmith Web and the desktop version for one low price. Check out BeersmithRecipes.com now to give Beersmith Web a try. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Mark Edelson, brewer and owner at Iron Hill Brewery in Philadelphia. Mark started as a home brewer and opened Iron Hill in 1996. He's brought home 49 GABF awards and has been brewing since 1990. Mark, it's great to have you back on the show. How are you doing?
Great to be back, Brad. Thanks for having me again.
It's a pleasure. It's been a whole 2 years now. We had you back on, November 2019. It was episode number 203. What have you been up to the last 2 years?
quite a bit, right? Certainly, it seems like an eternity since we last spoke, and certainly the world is has changed quite a bit since then. Obviously the pandemic happened.
That it did.
And for Iron Hill, we've always been a company that's been expanding its locations. We were under construction with 4 locations when the pandemic hit. And
I think including the big brewery behind you, right?
Yeah, the big brewery behind me, right? So as a brew pub company, we had put together some plans to build a larger facility, really to help our expansion and to add more brewery restaurants as we continue to expand what we were doing there. Mm-hmm. And then about the worst possible time, I mean, talk about having cash out on the street when you have 4 locations under construction. It was kind of a perfect storm for us of gloom and doom.
And I was kind of surprised when you told me the number of locations you have now. How many do you have now?
Yeah, so we have 20, including the production brewery behind me.
Wow.
Most of them in southeastern PA. We were founded in Delaware. Our first location is in Newark, Delaware, where the University of Delaware is. So we have 3 in Delaware, 2 in South Jersey. And then we have 1 in Greenville, South Carolina, and 2 in Atlanta that we opened during the pandemic. So,
good timing there.
Perfect, right? Yeah. All these office spaces that are still unoccupied, right, in downtown centers, and we have a location in Center City, Philadelphia, as well. So, what are our city locations, which are, were designed as our busiest ones, currently are some of our least busy ones, just mostly because the way that work has changed right now in the short term for people, and You know, people are not going into the offices. So,
yeah.
But, so, you know, it was a, I always say it was, there was a lot of dark days. I mean, we went from 1,650 employees to 125 in 10 days.
Oh, my goodness.
And,
really?
Yeah. And so wow. That's, you know, when, you know, certainly the pandemic was tragic in terms of loss of life, you know, friends and family members that people had. And certainly a huge burden on our healthcare workers and our healthcare system. But on the business side of it, it's hard to imagine a sector that was more impacted than hospitality. Hmm. You know,
well, and last time we did talk quite a bit about kind of homebrewing, and then we talked about how you started Iron Hill. But today you actually wanted to focus more on running the brewery.
Yes.
So, you know, I guess let's get the big one out of the way. How, you know, how has COVID impacted you the last 2 years? Well, you've certainly talked about it a little bit.
We certainly learned to tighten things up quite a bit, right?
Yeah.
In addition to trying to run 20 restaurants or build 4 restaurants and run 16, while you were coming out of the pandemic, you learned to be pretty lean with those things. But a really interesting thing happened to us. And while we were building a production brewery, its primary focus was really to support the expansion of restaurants, right? And certainly, as we sat during COVID, the expansion of restaurants didn't seem very likely in the future, right?
No.
But one thing that was happening was, you know, we had always used a mobile canner and canned product and sold it out the door. Well, as you know, canned product of beer and shot through the roof, right? It just skyrocketed. And
makes sense.
And we were selling our inventory. We had a lot, just like all restaurants and taverns and bars, we had a plethora of draft inventory, right? We always, everybody in the industry jokes that it was right before St. Patrick's Day. So we were serving dry stout in October, right? Just like everybody else.
That makes sense.
Everybody was geared up for that. And but what we didn't expect is all the can sales, right? And so the only brewing that we had to do for a long time was we had to brew to put beer into cans. I mean, we were using the mobile canner. The mobile canners were so busy during COVID. And you know, so it gave us pause to say, you know, building this production brewery, maybe we ought to diversify our revenue and get a little bit more into, you know, the distributing side. Look, we always enjoy serving beer across a bar, right? Mm-hmm. It's much more profitable than selling it in retail, where, you know, you're selling it through the distribution chain, and so at a much lower
fraction of the price.
And so, but when your primary source of revenue has been cut off completely, you start to rethink these things, right? So
right. And just so for reference, how big is the brewery behind you? How big a batch are you brewing?
It's a 30 barrel brewery. Yeah. The brew house is the brew length is 30 barrels. Our fermenters are 60 barrels and 120 barrels, and so
wow,
it really was geared to make a lot of beer, and as so we purchased a canning line as well and said, you know what, we're going to get into retail distribution. And so actually we made plans for it. You know, one of the things we did as a company is we focus a lot on what's going to happen when we get out of COVID, and, you know, this will end, but let's be in a growth mode when it does. And so we finished the construction of the restaurants that were underway and finished the construction. Once the bank saw some stability and opened the faucet back up to money, it allowed us to continue the construction of this. And we added the canning line to it. And actually, ahead of opening this facility, we actually used a contract brewer, a local friend of ours, to brew beer and put it in cans for our launch. And we launched locally in the tri-state area here in the Philly area into retail. So, you know, and it's going great. And so I would say there's not a lot of happy things coming out of COVID, but one of the things for us is it allowed us to pivot into something that we've been doing for 25 years, right? Making great beer, but to be able to find another channel where people could enjoy our beer.
Now, have you been able to reopen yet? A lot of the restaurants and pubs,
yeah.
or are they still closed? I mean, I was talking to Chris Graham the other day, and he said things like in California, it kept going open, close, open, close, open, close.
No, we weren't quite California out here. I would say that, you know, a lot of ours were closed to takeout only. And there was only one that we just, Center City, Philadelphia, at one point, it wasn't even worth keeping open for takeout. There just was nobody in Center City, Philadelphia.
Wow.
So we had closed that for probably about 3 months, but then opened it back up. So none of our sites have actually closed, but to have customers back in, we were open by the summer. We had last year, Pennsylvania shut down all indoor dining during the 3 weeks of December, mm-hmm. right? The most profitable weeks of the entire year. They decided that maybe we should shut everybody down. So that kind of got in our way of ramping back up. But since then, you know, the cities like Atlanta and Philadelphia that we're in have more restrictive practices. But outside of that, you know, we're probably like where you are, you know, people are out enjoying themselves. And, you know, I think Omicron gave people a little bit of pause during the holidays. So during the, you know, we saw a very strong start to December, but as you got into that Christmas week, people started going, you know, maybe I'm just going to hold off. So not like it was when we certainly were shut down, but we saw a little slowdown as we headed towards the end of the year, but it's coming back strong now. So we're of course very hopeful of things going into the spring.
Well, that's good news. Yeah, we're all hopeful that that certainly the pandemic starts to wind down here soon.
Sure.
Well, switching gears, I want to get to the other part of your business.
Sure.
So let's talk a little about business itself. How do you go about, for example, selecting your original lineup of beers? So you first opened up back in the 90s, I believe. How did you develop that first rack of beers?
Well, as you know, things were much different back in the 90s.
Yes, they were.
Right. And we didn't even call ourselves craft brewers, right? We were microbrewers, which I always hated that term because it sounds too sciencey and technical. Right. To what I think craft is a beautiful way to describe what we do.
Yeah.
So we had six beers, right? And that's what brew pubs did, right? They had six beers. That was it. That's all you needed to do.
Yeah.
And where we were different was that brew pubs never did lager, right? I mean, it just, that's what, you need tank space, you need time.
That's a lot of time, yeah.
Yeah. But we were very adamant that we should do lagers. And we opened Iron Hill with a lager. A Helles was one of our beers. In fact, within the first year of, we put it in the Great American Beer Festival and it won a gold medal, right? So, and we had a dark beer. So we had a porter, we had a British pale ale, we had an amber ale, we had a wheat beer, and we had a raspberry version of the wheat beer. And I think that is the six beers that we had, right? And so that was enough and people love those things, right? And so, but as you know, that has changed significantly since then.
Well, that was one of the things I want to ask you. So how has the lineup sort of evolved over the years? I mean, what are some things that became popular early on and maybe changed over the time?
Our Pig Iron Porter, we still brew. It's the same recipe since day one.
That's right? Cool.
It's the only one. It's absolutely the only one. Still my beer. Everything else that's on our list are has brewed, is designed and brewed, and none of it's mine. It's all theirs. But there's still one that's still there. We're a big believer of always having a dark beer, and it's such a great beer. And I think porter is that, you know, middle approachable dark beer that people can have. And
yeah,
so
I'm a huge fan of porter, so I'd probably enjoy that. But
and that one has never left. But everything else has changed, right? I mean, first from the number of beers, right? So I mean, brew pubs struggle to, you know, you see, look, Yard House has 50 to 100 beers on tap, right?
Right.
And every, you know, as Americans, we love more, 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 right? And I always say people love choice, but they hate to choose, right? They always go back to the same beer. So when you look at these multi taps, unfortunately, as brewers, you know that 15 to 20 of them move and the rest do not, right? They die a slow death on tap. And so we have 15 or 16 beers on tap at any one time, which is way more than the original six that we had.
But, I mean, that's certainly a good selection, yeah.
Yeah, it is. I believe that people can't look at a list bigger than 15 and make a choice, right? At that point, they just get too confused past that. So,
yeah, sometimes I go to these restaurants and they've got like 50-page menus and I don't even know where to start, you know?
Yeah, you don't. And you go back to what you know and there you go. You drink Sierra Nevada Pale Ale and you're done, right? So so we feel that that's a good number. Certainly what was deemed IPA in 1996 has become categories beyond, right? And, yeah. And so I think the things that really shifted is, one is we Americanized every style on the planet, right? We love to do that as Americans.
That's the case, yes.
We put American in front of everybody.
Except for American adjunct lager, which we basically don't talk about anymore, right?
Yes, exactly. And so it is, and it's funny because, you know, like Americans are not tied to historic traditions, right? You know, like the Germans and the British are, right? And so we feel we're free to change things, which is great. It creates innovation. Think about what happened in coffee, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, the 25-cent cup of coffee is long gone. And now, you know, Starbucks learned if you burn the beans enough, people call it bold flavor and you could sell it for $5, right? And so...
Or more.
or more. And I think that, you know, where we took that was with hops, right?
Right.
You're like more, right? I even remember, because that's come full circle now, right? Because I remember when people were making IBU claims that were physically impossible to get into beer, right? Remember?
Well, you know, interesting factoid, but your taste buds burn out at like, I don't know what it is, 70, 80 IBUs for most people. So anything beyond that doesn't really matter.
Everybody is like, this is like over 100 IBUs. Yeah. You're like, really?
Can 300, right?
Can that physically happen, right? And like you said, can you even taste it any, right? But that's what it had become, right? And now we're making these softer East Coast style IPAs, right? That are hazy and are wonderful flavors and don't accentuate the IBUs as much.
Kind of fruity, yeah.
Fruity and really celebrate the beautiful essence of the hops. And so, you know, we've been, and you know, starting 10, 15 years ago, you started to see Europeans using American hops, which you would never see 10 years before that. They wouldn't even consider it. It was an insult, right? And so here Americans have innovated. But, you know, the downside of it is the classic styles are gone, right? I mean, we can't sell a British ESB, right? It's such a beautiful style. It's so delicate, but you can't sell it. Right?
There was a lovely period of time when I could go to the grocery store and pick from all the different styles of beer, but they've all been pushed out by IPAs now.
They really have. Yeah. They really have. And you know, and think about it. Just Belgian. Look, we're an interesting thing. We've always done a Belgian event, right? That we haven't been able to do the last 2 years, right? And we're going around trying, and we always try to highlight not Belgian-made beers, but Americans making Belgian-style beers, right? Mm-hmm. We can't find them anymore. There's not breweries making Belgian beers anymore. I mean, remember in the late 90s, that just surge of America's love for Belgian beers?
Oh, sure.
And anything Belgian. And certainly Philadelphia was one of the leaders of that with Monk's Cafe and everything that brought Belgian beer to the forefront of the U.S. And sadly, nobody's brewing them anymore because nobody's drinking them anymore, right? And all these great things that we as craft brewers tried to replicate, you know, the Americans have moved on from that stuff, and that's a shame.
Yeah, I agree. So what are some of the top selling beers you have at the moment? I mean, is it the hazy IPA and IPA?
It's hazy and juicy and
juicy,
more hazy and juicy, right?
Yeah.
And I always tell the story because we have a lot of young and innovative brewers, right? And I became the old man on the lawn in his chair yelling and screaming, get off my lawn, right? With the hazy. I'm like, beer is beautiful, right? It needs to be filtered unless it's a Hefeweizen, you know.
I assume you lost that battle.
I did. Eventually, I lost it. And then when I saw the sales, I was like, I can't deny sales, right? And so we always have, you know, we don't bring other beers in. We don't bring national beers in as well. But so we've always brewed a light beer, right? Mm-hmm. It's a craft-made light beer. It is always one of our top-selling beers because we're in the restaurant business, and half of beer sold in America is a low-calorie light beer, right? So, you know, it's crazy to think that people coming into our restaurants are going to be different than the rest of America. You know, they're going to lean a little bit more craft, but no, half of our beer sold is not light lager. It's 15%, but it was always historically one of our top single brand selling. Mm-hmm. Not anymore. Hazy Juicy Eclipse. Pushed it all out, right? It is the new best brand. It's the new flagship for everybody.
So are there any non-IPA beers that sell well, or is that it now?
No, it's still, you know, we make an amber lager, which if you're in Pennsylvania, everybody loves amber lager.
I can see that.
So we sell a lot of Vienna lager.
That's good.
You know, but again, we sell a lot of different styles. We're seeing people trying to move back into West Coast IPAs, right? Mm-hmm. So we still make West Coast IPAs, right? We still, of course, still in the IPA categories. Sours, you know, less traditional sours, right?
Yeah.
And more like kettle sours, which are softer.
Kettle sours, certainly easier to make too, right?
They're easier to make. They're more approachable to people. You know, you still, if you put a traditional sour out there, which we make them, here and there, they're for the connoisseur, right? And so my daughter declared herself a lover of sours, right? She was down in Virginia. She went to James Madison.
Okay.
And she lives in Arlington now, right? Mm-hmm. She goes, Dad, I love sour beers. I'm like, do you really? Right? And so looking at what she drinks kettle sours, which have great fruit flavor into them. And I describe them more as tart. Rather than sour beers, but great. If that brings people in to trying these different beers, and we have a whole kettle sour program, right? Our Saturday That's morning awesome. Series where we use different. So, you know, we try to stay plugged into what is going on out there and what the hot styles are.
So, how do you go about deciding which beers are worthy of adding to the lineup? Do you have? I assume you have a pilot brewery of some kind.
No, we don't.
I mean, huh?
We have 19 pilot breweries, right?
Oh, 19.
So, right? So all of our breweries are, you know, are 10 barrel, 10 hectoliter systems. And people always ask, well, do you brew on a homebrew system? I said, you know, we're well past that. You know, we understand enough about ingredients.
Yeah.
That we're, you know, what may happen with a beer is it's not exactly as the brewer intended it, but it's not. There's not anything wrong with beer, right?
So right. It's not going to be on another planet or something, right?
No. I didn't quite get the character that I wanted out of this hop or that hop. And then you make tweaks to it to refine the recipe. So, you know, we try to, sometimes I feel like we probably make samey-sames, right?
Yeah.
We're switching out two hops and calling it something different, but you see that throughout the marketplace, right?
Yeah.
But I feel then sometimes, we do single hop beers, which accentuate the certain characteristics of a hop, and customers certainly that like to enjoy a lot of those things too. But you know, I think you have to keep it interesting. I think that you can't have six hazy juicies on and expect there to be that much differentiation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I mean, how do you sit down and how do you actually decide which beers go into the lineup?
Do you
allow 19 of them to experiment, or
we give them, first of all, our beer menu has some guidelines, right?
So, okay.
We have six coors, which are the same at every restaurant, right? So that's what they have to brew those coors, and then from there we really give them guidelines to the styles that should be on tap.
So I assume you're talking about a core beer and not Coors beer, right?
Yeah, yes, a core beer. So those are, and then within the styles, we say, look, you should have two hazy juices, you should have a West Coast, we need a pale lager on, so we go back and forth, and then they get either, sometimes we use company recipes that have been proven over the years, or they'll try a new beer that they want to try to develop, and, just with some guidance, somebody will review them. I have to say that I don't review recipes anymore. Right. No. I have people that do that, right? The guys that are a lot of our crew that is very competent in it, and I don't necessarily need to be involved in that. But I'm heavily involved in the styles that we should be keeping on tap. And so it gives the freedom of brewers to go ahead and try different things and to come up with recipes. I'm gonna try a little bit our King's Gold here, which just won a gold medal at the 21 Great American Beer Festival.
Oh, awesome.
In the American Pilsner category, right?
Wow.
So again, for brew pubs, we're always surprising people that by winning medals in lager categories, right? And so this is I'm going to pour it.
He's going to hold it up here. He's pouring the beer right now for those of you in audio.
Right.
Looks beautiful actually from here.
Right. Isn't that what beautiful beer
is? It is, yeah.
And
it is.
I always tell people this is how God intended
it. It's not hazy enough though.
It's not hazy, right? You know, so it's not hazy enough.
But, not hazy at all, actually.
Right. But you know what? Our customers love it, right? This is where people just get tired and they're like, I like to go back to, this stuff. Right. Yeah. And so it's a pre-prohibition beer, right? So
it looks really delicious.
Yes, and is absolutely. I'm going to send you down some.
So how do you decide to take you got 19 breweries that are trying new things. How do you decide what to actually push up to the production brewery?
That's interesting. So the production brewery will brew some draft, core draft for it, but for cans.
Yeah.
What we do is we look at draft sales, right? So mm-hmm. customers tell us what is popular, right?
By
the choices they make. And we always have that discussion with brewers that want to rebrew something, right? Because in a brewer's mind, everything they made personally sold great, right?
Right.
but you
pull out the actual numbers, huh?
Exactly. I'm like, we can go to the videotape on this one for sure. let's see how that held up. Like, you want to stick with that statement? Or
how long did that one sit in the keg?
Exactly. So, or this stuff that we just knew flew through it. And, as much as we try to circulate around and taste all the beers that are made, and sometimes you taste a beer and you're like, wow,
yeah.
Right? This is really, and so we look to that because every year we look to introduce new cans into the lineup. And again, that's not necessary for retail now. So we've got this great process by which we can put a beer in cans and just sell it in our restaurants, right? It doesn't have to go out on the retail.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
There's less of a commitment. There's a huge commitment to come up with a beer and launch it into the retail market, right?
Right. You get packaging concerns and marketing concerns and so on, right?
And so we can sell it out our doors, and then from there, we can look at how well that sells. And then from there, we can decide what we want to jump into retail. We're going to do a milkshake IPA in retail this year, right?
Yeah, you must be thrilled.
No, You know what? It's fantastic. Here's the story of this one. It was brewed and in the tank, and then COVID hit, right?
Right.
And unfortunately, the guy that brewed it was furloughed, right? And so our crew that was left was running around kegging off beers, and we took this one and we sent it out to a couple of our restaurants, and it was on tap. And I brought some home, and I have several kids now who have graduated college and they were college age at the time, and they're all drinking it and they're going, Dad, this is fantastic, right? And I was drinking, I'm like, yeah, it's pretty good. And it was flying out everywhere across the company. And so we rebrewed it, and again, it flew. And so I'm always nervous about putting a milkshake IPA in a can, right? I don't want to create bombs.
No.
And so we put it in the production brewery and put it in cans for sale in 2021 out the door in our restaurants, and it flew out. And so this year, it's in our calendar to introduce into retail this summer.
That's awesome. Well,
yeah,
that's cool.
So, you know, that's a great, having both the retail portion with the brew pubs and a production brewery, like I said, gives us 19, you know, labs to try different things and to put it in front of customers.
That's very cool. And then the other obviously question is how do you retire a beer? How do you decide that this one's not going to be brewed again? Is it all sales driven, or are there other things that come into it?
A lot of it is sales driven.
That doesn't surprise me.
My first Christmas ale that I did just should never be brewed again, right? it was before, you know, when you're a home
brewer. How many Christmases was it around?
Way too long. And, you know, as a home brewer, I think the biggest jump problem you have from home brewing to larger scale brewing is scaling things like spices and flavors, right?
Yeah, I could see that.
It's just not linear in any way, right? And my first Christmas beer had way too much spice in it. It just was, so that
it's kind of like hops. I think you get much higher utilization from the spices, right?
Yeah. But some, you know, we brewed some beers that were hits and what do you call it? 5 years later, nobody's buying it, right? And sometimes sales drive that a little bit. Change in tastes and all that. It kind of do that. I'll tell you this great story.
Yeah.
So I had this idea when we're doing a lot of barrel aging, right? And I love hot sauce. I was like, you know what? We should age a beer in a Tabasco barrel, right? And everyone's like, well, my brewery team was like, no way. Absolutely not. I'm like, no, we're going to do it. So I found one of our assistant brewers who bought into it, right? I'm like, come on, we'll do this together, right? So I called McElhinney's down in Louisiana, and they sent up a Tabasco barrel and then all this paperwork because they wanted to make sure if we're going to use the name Tabasco that we used it right, which I appreciated. And I aged our porter in a Tabasco barrel, right? Mm-hmm. So when we went to taste it, it was undrinkable, right? Which I guess you would expect. But what we decided is we're going to blend it off, right? Mm-hmm. And so we blended off and cut it down until it got to a flavor profile. And then we bottled it. And we were doing a lot of cork finish bottling, right? It was called Ring of Fire.
Okay.
Of course. But what I forgot is, you know, when you age in like a whiskey barrel, you're aging in a spirits barrel, right?
Right.
When you're aging in what is essentially a food barrel, right? There's a lot more things going on there, right?
Yeah.
And so we saw, I think one beer writer said, when you open this, make sure you wear a hockey mask.
Oh, my.
Right? Yes. And so there were bombs of these, right? And so it was interesting. We just celebrated our 25th anniversary. And we had an anniversary event at our very first location in Newark, Delaware. And my partner showed up with all these beers he had saved over the years, including two Ring of Fires. And I'm like, you know, fire in the hole, right? What are you doing? These are bombs, right? And so they were kept cold for 20 years. And we did open them. And surprisingly, they tasted great. They really did. You could taste the...
They just needed to be aged for a little while. That's the key.
Yes, exactly.
Well, just age them for 20 years. It's like a Barolo wine or something, right?
Yeah.
Since you developed quite a few award-winning recipes over the years, how do you personally sit down and go... I know you're not developing a lot of recipes at the moment, but how do you sit down and develop a new recipe starting with a blank sheet of paper?
Well, I think that, and as we teach people how to do this, right?
Yeah.
The first thing is to visualize what you want, right? And you have to, and usually that's by, I want to make a beer like this, You know, I mean, it's a lot harder to say I'm going to just come up with something completely new, right? I think very few beers are developed that way.
Yeah.
But I think what you do is you take inspiration from what others do. And we always encourage all of our staff, brewery staff, to be out there and trying other products. So and that's the beauty of going to the Great American Beer Festival, right? Because in one building, you have so many beers that are outstanding. And you know the breweries to go to. And you can, you know, and you can sit at their booth and taste. And I think that creates inspiration, right? And then from there, what you do is you take what you know and you develop the recipe. What you know about ingredients, what you know about hops, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do I need to put together? I always try to make sure that it's not too complicated because I don't think it needs to be. But, you know, it doesn't need 15 malts, right?
Right. No, I agree. Simplicity is a fundamental precept, I think.
Yes. And so, but knowing what you know about recipe development, and that's where I think, you know, and certainly our suppliers are always coming out, malt suppliers are always coming out with different malts, different specialty malts.
Right, right.
That they want you to try. And there's ways to, you know, to steep them and try to see what the flavors are, and again, visualize that. And certainly the hop programs are they're putting new hops in front of us all the time that they want us to try. And so these are opportunities for our crew to try to take some of these new things and make something unique and different with using what they know. You know, what's they know this, their systems efficiencies. They know, so they know what the malt bill needs to be.
Right.
They know how the hop utilization works in it. They know how to dry hop. You know, sometimes if it's a new hop, you have to guess at dry hopping, right? I mean,
yeah.
You take a stab at it, and we're always trying to make sure that our pounds per barrel of hop usage are not so insane that it's upside down on costs. I mean, you can't charge $13 for a pint, right? But
no.
Sometimes we're making beers that only make money like that, right? So we're always kind of pulling, you know, we teach the business side of it as well, right? We have to make a profit, so we have to make it profitable, and not, this isn't just fun time,
right?
To throw everything you want at it. So, you know, our brewers have financial bonuses as well, in terms of running their operation. So, you know, and that's important thing to learn, because you've got to run a whole operation, right? It's just not cool kids making cool stuff, right? It's a business like anything. And
no, it's not like homebrewing. One of the things I love about like HomebrewCon, you go to HomebrewCon and you have you go to Homebrew Night, and it's just unbelievable because people can make stuff that's, you know, completely commercially infeasible. You know what I mean?
So I'll tell you a story. So right after we spoke last, and I don't know if I talked about it, but we were doing this competition, Brew with a Legend, where we
had
five.
You mentioned that at the end of the show, I think.
Yes. And I'm going to, so let me bring it full circle. So it was great. Cause I went to five different areas where we, you know, cause we tried to regionalize it. So we had five areas where people could compete. And then one was down in the South. Right. And I was involved in some of the judging, but we had one winner in every region, and they got to brew their beer at Iron Hill.
Right.
And then I would brew with them. And, you know, I go to a lot of the clubs that we sponsor and stuff like that, but not really brew with them. Mm-hmm. And so I got to brew with them, and talking with them, the advances in homebrewing equipment were on a much different planet than in 1994 and 95 when my partner.
I mentioned I had Chris Graham on last week and last episode, and we were talking about, you know, it's stainless everything now. It's just incredible.
Oh, it is.
And I remember everything in the 90s was cobbled together with igloo coolers and, you know,
yes,
whatever hose I could get from the hardware store, you know.
We splurged because we had a Sankey keg that was a kettle and a louder ton, right?
Wow.
So you put the screen in the bottom and you louder, and then you dump it out, because then you ran off into the pot, right?
Yeah.
We just had a pot, and then we used the keg and put it on top of the Cajun cooker, and then we
boiled. I mean, there's guys that have glycol systems at home now. It's incredible, you know?
Right, right. But what the most amazing one was that there's this, and you know what it is. You put it in your carboy, and it's got Bluetooth, and it tells you the temperature and gravity.
Yeah, right? You're probably thinking of the tilt hydrometer, although there are a few competing ones, I think.
Uh-huh. And I was like, what? Like, the guy showed me on his phone all the stuff he had in carboys and what it was. And I was like, oh, God, we don't have that, right? And so I'm looking at the devices, and what I realize is they don't transmit through stainless, right? So
no, probably not.
We can't throw them into a fermenter in the brewery and get that. I was like, oh. But it just made me really think about the advantages that homebrewers have that we didn't have back then. I heard your discussion with Chris, and one of the things I was surprised about was how many you talked about a move back to all grain brewing. And when we were brewing, we were always all grain brewers, you know? And it seems like maybe there was a turn where people went back to more simplistic and doing extracts again. But we were always all grain brewers.
I mean, the move now is actually towards smaller systems, I think, partially because of COVID.
Sure.
So a lot of people are brewing 5-gallon batches when they had 10 or 15, 20-gallon systems, you know.
So I have a beer in front of me.
Right? Oh, there's another one.
And now, so this one was one of the award-winning beers, right? And so I went. It is a beet beer, right?
So is it made with beets?
It's made with beets. It's a Saison made with beets, right?
That's cool.
And when I saw the entry, and I was like, oh, God, what is this thing, right? And it won, and I was not judging in that region. So I called the brewers. I'm like, how could that be, right? How could a beet beer be the, right? Uh-huh. And they're like, no, we're telling you, it was by far, without a doubt, the best beer on the table. I'm like, really? And I went to brew it, and we used our hop back, which we don't use hop backs much anymore, right? But we have hop backs. And the kitchen cut and peeled all these beets, right? And we filled the hop back with beets, right? And it looked literally like a murder scene, right?
It's red, even the finished beer is pretty red there, well, right?
But the runoff looked like that, right?
Yeah.
And Saison is the perfect style to have the earthiness of the beets in it, right? It's got this beautiful ruby color.
It does.
And, I love the flavor of it, right? And in classic style of good homebrewers, it's called Dewey Beat 'em and How, right? And so, yes, you laugh because you're a Three Stooges fan, right?
Yeah.
So all of us older people know that it is the derivative of Dewey Cheat 'em and How, the law firm from the Three Stooges. And so, so that's a fun story of our one of our homebrew competitions.
That's awesome. Along those lines, is there anything you tried that you really thought was going to be just fantastic and maybe didn't quite work out in practice?
Well, certainly, the Tabasco beer.
Yeah. And you mentioned the holiday beer, but maybe,
yes.
I'm sure you have others.
Well, I will tell you that I love German Pilsners. I love the German Pilsners that we make, right? And the Czech Pilsners. And everyone keeps talking about the return of Pilsners, right, in the craft segment. Mm-hmm. And it just, I keep hoping and hoping for it. It kind of hangs on the edge there, right? Like I said, this beer is, we're really hopeful that it come, as we've released it and it's award-winning, we know it's going to sell. But I just, I'm hoping for these classic styles to really regain some ground in customers' minds.
And I mean, we've had a bit of a shakeout the last 2 years. There's a lot of craft breweries that obviously did not make it. Where do you see craft beer kind of going in the next few years? I mean, what's going to be the next hazy IPA or trendy style?
The next trendy style will be another type of IPA.
Yeah, right? Well, that's probably true, but yeah.
It will be, right? The last six have been IPAs, right?
Yeah.
So it will be some other derivative of that. But, you know, now that we're in retail, we have an expanded view, you know. Mm-hmm. The shelves are still overcrowded, right?
Yeah.
Some have dropped off. I just read the Beer Summit is this weekend, which is run by a beer business daily, and I'm not out there, but all the big wigs. So Jim Cook got interviewed, and they asked him about where things are going within that, and are innovative products starting to be the next thing? And he said clearly, beer as it once was is not going to grow much in the future, right? Hmm. And it's going to be innovative products, right? Whether beer products or, you know, certainly Sam Adams has cornered the market with Truly on the seltzer side and with the iced tea side of things. But, you know, look, as brewers, we see the RTDs out there and all the other products that are out there that interfere with the beer space, to be honest. I mean, they compete in the beer space.
Well, I mean, if you look at the raw numbers, I think beer consumption peaked in like the late 50s or something like that.
Really. Sure.
Yeah.
Right.
So, it has been in a decline for quite a long time. It's just craft beer obviously has been growing at the expense of, you know, the traditional lagers.
And spirits are making their way slowly in as well with that. So, look, for beer, for right now, it's going to be innovation. Like you said, the next IPA will be what everyone needs to shift to, right? Mm-hmm. To keep beer relevant. And, you know, it used to be beer against beer for the next great thing. And now it's beer against other things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And do brewers start making those products or do they just try to compete against them? So, there's a lot of challenging things for brewers in the next decade.
Well, I've seen huge growth in the craft beer space the last 10 years. I mean, do you think it's going to flatten out? I mean, certainly there was a shakeout during the pandemic, but
I think so at the expense of other, like I said, other, not that, you know, people that are in craft and looking for something different
mm-hmm.
are going to try other things potentially. Right. Mm. Especially on the younger age people.
Yeah.
So we have some challenges ahead of us to be innovative and create interesting products.
Right.
The challenge for us is to create the interesting products within the beer space.
Mm. Well, you've been in the business for a long time. What are your closing thoughts, Mark, after having you all this time?
My closing thoughts are this, is that what we really learned during COVID was the value of local, right? So many businesses were saved because deep down people appreciate their family and and they consider local businesses family, right?
True.
And the beauty of craft beer and craft brewers is that, especially the really small ones, is that we're local, right? We are your local brewery and all that. And so, you know, that's an advantage to us. And I hope that doesn't become unfashionable or get, you know, fall out of favor, that people continue to support local, because that's what will be keeping craft beer going and craft brewers going, is the support from local. So I guess my message to your listeners is make sure that you go out and support your local restaurant and support your local brewery, your local beer garden, all of the local business people.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really appreciate you being here and taking time out of your busy schedule.
Great, Brad. Thanks. Welcome to great being here.
Today, my guest was Mark Edelson, brewer and owner at Iron Hill Brewery and winner of some 49 GABF awards. Thanks again, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
A big thank you to Mark Edelson for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also the Brew Commander, the brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. To order yours today, visit BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, the web-based version of Beersmith is available now at BeersmithRecipes.com. Beersmith for the Web lets you build, edit, and brew recipes from any browser, including your desktop, tablet, or mobile device. You can try Beersmith Web for 30 days by setting up a free account at BeersmithRecipes.com. If you purchase a Gold, Platinum, or Pro license, you get both Beersmith Web and the desktop version for one low price. Check out BeersmithRecipes.com and give it a try today. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.